Welcome to our panel on environmental law and regulation. I do want to start off with one announcement. One of our panelists, Jonathan Cannon, who is the director of the environmental law program at the University of Virginia, is not here this morning. So I think we'll have a little bit of a different kind of conversation, but I think very robust nonetheless. I am Coral Davenport. I cover energy and environment for National Journal. To my right is David Rifkin, partner at Baker and Hostetler. To my left is Roger Martella, partner at Sidley Austin and former general counsel at EPA. David, would you like to start us off?
Well, thanks very much. When the agency interprets a statutory term like 250 tons to mean 75,000 tons, in my view, we of a situation where administrative law has gone seriously off the rails. I refer, of course, to EPA's famous and infamous tailing rule, which was the linchpin of its first round of regulations to control greenhouse gas emissions by stationary sources. I would also try to convince you that this is this problem, while serious in its own right, is emblematic of a broader problem where administrative law these days does not really cabin executive branch agencies and departments very well, and the court's response to this particular situation has been to put a charitably judicial disengagement, and this problem is continuing with new regulations on their ways. Now let me talk a little bit about, hopefully tantalize you with my 250-ton analogy, let me talk a little bit in detail what happened here. So these problems have arisen in the context of the administration's effort to control carbon. I think it falls easier off the tongue than greenhouse gases. It's, I would say, a policy priority of the executive branch, this administration, and not shared by Congress, not at least as enough to pass cap and trade or any other version of legislation. Now, MASS versus EPA, which some of you may recall, of course, said that the definition of pollutant in Section 302G of the Clean Air Act is capacious enough to encompass regulation of carbon from motor vehicles, provided EPA issues an endangerment finding, justifying any need for such emissions. What followed then, that happened at the tail end of Bush 43, what followed from the then fairly new Obama administration was the series of regulations designed to connect the fairly modest holding of Massachusetts with an ambitious policy goal, and that really was to regulate, frankly speaking, carbon from existing stationary sources, particularly power plants. So there are several dominoes that fell. The first one was the endangerment finding that the Supreme Court said that EPA could do, but let me say very clearly, did not have to do, just exercising discretion. Then EPA next issued the so-called tailpipe rule, which contained emission standards for light-duty motor vehicles. The rule was a bit of a sham in that EPA adopted the same standards as the corporate average fuel economy, known as CAFE, that was adopted by the National Highway Transportation Safety Boards. In a way, really, the Clean Air Act did not add anything beyond what NHTSA has done, but as you see in a second, there were means to an important end. The end came into focus with the third rule, cumbersomely known as Johnson Memorandum Reconsideration, or less of a tongue twister, as the timing rule. In that rule, the agency expressed its view of a Clean Air Act, once any pollutant is subject to regulation, quote unquote, under any provision of a Clean Air Act, including automotive tailpipe emissions, it automatically regulated under portions of the Act applicable to stationary sources, and that meant that the tailpipe rule was designed and did so force the regulation of carbon under the heart of a stationary source, a regulation, a control program of the Clean Air Act called Prevention of Significant Deterioration of PSD. But, ladies and gentlemen, there was one major problem with this approach. It was completely unworkable. And the reason for it is because Congress created a PSD program of an expectation would apply to a few hundred of a larger stationary source in the country, power plants, chemical plants, other major facilities, what Congress called major emitting facilities. And towards that end, the Congress specified hard numerical thresholds to determine whether a particular facility is subject to PSD program. And in general, the source has to, a new modified source has to emit more than 250 tons of a given pollutant. And then you're subject to the PSD program, you're supposed to get a permit. and as a condition of getting the permit, you need to install best available control technology. Little problem, if you look at the CO2 emission profile, instead of having a few hundred sources, you have hundreds of thousands of sources that EPA and the states would have to regulate, would have to go for the program. It cannot be done. It's just pretty damn impossible. EPA's solution was the so-called tailing rule, which I don't think it's a funny matter, but let me be whimsical and say in the way EPA tailored the specific statutory language is by rewriting it. They basically said that 250 tons really means 75,000 tons, and therefore the carbon portion of the PSD program is only applicable to the largest sources, primarily power plants, and that avoids the regulatory train wreck. Now, whatever the policy merits of his decision, I would submit to you that it was not even conceivably lawful and should have gone down, even in the fairly deferential venue of a DC circuit. Fortunately for EPA, no court ever had to answer this question, and its challenge to the EPA regulatory, and considering the challenge to the EPA regulatory scheme that was brought by industry and states, the DC circuit held in its great wisdom, but because the tailing rule was actually the regulatory, because it imposed a smaller burden than the full bore PSD program, there was no injury to any party, and therefore there was no standing to vindicate that interest. And now the rules, endangerment, and tailpipe and timing were held to be an agency's broad discretion. So by breaking this exercise of trying to control carbon from stationary sources into four discrete parts, EPA rewrote the Clean Air Act and adopted a regulatory approach that had it come to a DC circuit in its combined form. I'm not naive about the DC circuit, would not have been a slam dunk, but certainly would have been a better, much better shot at taking it down. They did not do that, and they got away with it, at least at the DC circuit level. There's actually a petition for certiorari pending before the Supreme Court in this case, and we'll know soon enough if a case will be heard in the fall. Now, for most folks, this is where the carbon story ends. It actually continues. The tailing rule was just the beginning of a carbon saga because EPA faced another problem. What they've done is they issued rules of general applicability, but most of you who have been following the Clean Air Act know that the act is really driven, cannot be done by federal government directly, really driven by the states, who adopt something called SIP, State Implementation Plans, that have to translate the requirements and rules of general applicability into the state-specific strategies, and EPA is supposed to look at those plans. It's a big deal to do those plans, takes a lot of effort, you know, supposed to respect states as co-equal sovereigns. You cannot tell them to turn on a dime, so I'll spare you the precise dates, but let's just say the Act envisions in Section 110 that there's a long time period that you're supposed to, you know, turn the supertanker around and tell states that they have to change their program. And while they're changing it, what controls is what was in their SIPs before. Needless to say, no SIPs control carbon. So you'd think EPA, having just won the rules of general national applicability, would let it rest, but that's not how they decided to do things. They decided to force states to immediately, virtually immediately, implement those rules. Now, how do you do that, given what I just told you about Section 110 and the border constitutional realities about how you treat co-equal sovereigns? Seems like you wouldn't be able to do that if you complied with the Act. Well, it's easy enough, you use brute force. In late 2010, EPA told state regulators that if they refused to reinterpret their SIPs, which, by the way, are species of both federal and state law, perfectly symmetrical, that if you do not immediately reinterpret your SIPs to regulate carbon, the PSD portion of it, they would be unable to issue their permits come January 2, 2011, which just weeks later. The country, as you may recall, was not in great economic shape at the time, and having such a construction moratorium was not politically very palatable, so EPA squeezed all the states. 49 of them blinked. The greatest state of Texas did not blink. Oh, by the way, when I say blinked, the way it was supposed to be, so you either rewrite your own SIP or reinterpret your own SIPs like slate law, or you adopt an unrealistically short time period, 30 days yourself, to change it, fail, and then let EPA come in and do something called FIP, Federal Implementation Plan, which basically supplants you as a permitting authority. Texas is the only one who said no, state that said no. Actually, the choice even the choice that EPA gave, and it was not much of a choice, as probably evident by somewhat sarcastic tone of my comments, was a false one in any case, because rather than let Texas rest on its rights, EPA took a separate action and supplanted Texas's program anyway, promulgated the FIP under a wonderful theory that 20 years ago, when it approved EPA's SIP, it did not notice, but it did not have an automatic updating provision that allowed the new pollutants to come into the PSD program. By the way, how is it compatible with EPA's view that you cannot regulate carbon in the PSD program where you regulate all other pollutants and had to wait until the Taylor rule to do that is a different story. But suffice to say, the act contained no such updating requirement. EPA never before required such a thing. If it requires it now, most of the SIPs in the country would be deficient, but that was not sufficient to stop it. So this was an unprecedented action that got challenged. Once again, I'm sorry to say no court came to rescue, at least not speedily. The D.C. Circuit said on the challenges to implementation of it, I should say, in full disclosure, I represent the great state of Texas in this matter, so I have somewhat of a vested interest here, didn't give us any preliminary relief, said on things for 2 years, which I said on our argument last month. And during this time, EPA regulated with a free hand. Now, that's sort of stage two. Now, you think that that's enough. They got away with rules of national applicability. They pretty much emasculated all the SIPs. Well, it's not enough because there's a third round coming. Last year, following the Sue and Seto agreement, which my good friend Roger knows very well what it means given his past experience in government, settlement sue agreement with environmental organizations, EPA proposed what is known as new source performance standard that sets out carbon requirements for power plants. And the nice thing about it is that the emission profile of a coal-fired plant, according to this proposal, must achieve the same level of emission reductions as a gas-fired plant. Bottom line is you're not going to be able to construct any coal-fired plant. Pretty much the case now in any given other things that EPA has done, but this is a little bit more blatant. An agency has basically acknowledged this problem. And while the agency was quite eager to get the NSPS for new sources out, the agency lawyers, or maybe some other lawyers, have realized that despite the fact they've gotten away with many other things so far, there's a little bit of a legal risk here because, I mean, to put it somewhat crisply, aside from my carbon coal-fired and gas-fired plant, let me give you a more pithy analogy. This is like saying that best control automobiles is in fact a bicycle, and therefore all cars and trucks should have an emission profile of a bicycle. So the rule is basically on hold for now as the lawyers are trying to figure out how to do it. And that also put at least a temporary stop to the administration's real goal, which I mentioned in the beginning of my presentation, which is to go after carbon emissions of existing sources. And the way you do that is to have an NSPS standard for existing sources, and that would be sort of an ultimate combination of administrations. One call, you have standards that are impossible to achieve, or at least wildly unaffordable. Congress, of course, did not intend such a thing, but who cares? And there are serious problems with what EPA is thinking about doing relative to standards for existing sources. They want to do it under a section of the Clean Air Act, and I apologize for throwing the section numbers, but hard to talk about the section 111D. And the problem, of course, is you can make very good arguments that it does not apply to power plants to the extent they've been regulated under a different section of the Clean Air Act 112. But to finish briefly, aside from that, even aside from sort of the legal technicalities here, if you try to proceed with an SPS the way it's always been done, you have the same problem as with PSD and carbon. You would have to shut down in short order 40% of existing power generation, which even this administration would find difficult to swallow. So the administration, by all accounts, has a different scheme of mind, create wholesale kind of a cap and trade program at the state level that would enable you to strangle existing coal-fired installed fleet, but slowly. Would not be particularly legal as far as I'm concerned. Let me close by saying that those tax in addition to being horrible in their own right, at least in my view, so manifest three things, so which is where I begin. We have agencies that are not much cabined by existing statutes. We have judicial review administrative law that does not impose much of a discipline on those agencies, and we have doctrines of standing and various other obscure things I'll be happy to elaborate on the D.C. Circuit that make very difficult for anybody to challenge such cockamamie interpretations of the Act. All in all, not a very good situation.
Okay. Roger, Ryan.
Thank you, Coral, for the introduction. David, for leading things off. And good afternoon, everyone. The subject for today is environmental law and regulations. And what I want to do is maybe just hit three themes where I think these environmental law and regulations are kind of morphing or transitioning kind of before our eyes the last few years and in the upcoming couple years as well, some predictions along the way. What I want to talk about is the way kind of the mission of EPA has been changing and evolving, and so have their regulations. And then some of the challenges this is presenting to those who are concerned about environmental regulations, looking to challenge regulations, and then also some opportunities for those too who are interested in these developments and these evolutions. So the first thing I want to talk about is kind of the way environmental regulations are evolving, the way kind of the mission of Environmental Protection Agency has been changing in the last few years, and the way it seems to be changing right now as well. And I think there has been kind of a fundamental shift in kind of how the agency has defined this agenda in the last few years that's kind of distinctly different than earlier decades in its history. It's obviously an environmental protection agency, and since 1970, it's always been concerned about protecting and bettering the environment and public health and human welfare. I'm not suggesting that's not what it's about today, but the way it's done that in the past has been different than some of the ways it's doing it now. In the past, it's been primarily concerned about things that come out of smokestacks and pipes and pollution and things that can kind of harm you directly. So if you have a pollutant coming out of a smoke pipe or out of a pipe into a waterway, EPA has been all about kind of stopping that from happening, regulating that and controlling that until you get to a safe level. What has been fundamentally changed, I think, in the last few years is it's still doing that. That's still its primary mission. But it's added a new mission along the way, which is not only control kind of pollutants coming out of things, but also the type of energy and the use of energy along the way. And I would actually argue it's gone from being just an environmental protection agency to also one of the lead, if not the lead regulators of energy in the country right now. And there's a couple of examples of that. And I think it's a fundamental distinction because controlling energy is not so much controlling about what comes out of something, but the type of energy going into a process and also how efficient you use that energy. And there are a couple of examples of that. David's touched on them briefly as well. And if you look at the very first thing, significant thing the Obama EPA did back in 2009 was enact these CAFE standards that ultimately will reach 54.5 MPG by 2025. And that's a doubling of the CAFE standards. And obviously that's an environmental consequence, but it's also the way you do that is you become more energy efficient. It's truly a regulation of energy itself and not just kind of things coming out of a tailpipe of a car. And one of the other areas we see, we talk a lot about CAFE standards, but we also have to recognize probably one of the most significant environmental issues in Washington right now and energy issues is the renewable fuel standard. How EPA is having some challenges meeting mandates set out for renewable and cellulosic and advanced and biofuels set by Congress in 2007. And it's really facing some, you know, really formidable challenges. Last year there was a drought. This year we're talking about blend wall issues. There's just simply not enough opportunity to put ethanol into the system. EPA has admitted there's a domestic lack of supply of some advanced biofuels. And so it's confronting these challenges. And in doing so, it's exercising huge control over not just kind of conventional fuels, but biofuels and alternative fuels. But if we talk about this transition to going from an environmental protection agency to also being primarily a regulator of energy, I don't think there's probably a better example than greenhouse gases and new source performance standards. David has talked a lot about kind of the permitting process for greenhouse gases. But to me, the fundamental, and you know, in my own personal view, the most significant thing that's happened in the last 4 years has been a proposal to regulate greenhouse gases for utilities under the new source performance standards. And this proposal came out just about a year ago. It's actually in effect. There's this unique provision of the law that makes these new source performance standards in effect at the time they're proposed. And what it has done, and this is not just me saying, it's just a fact, it has phased out the construction of any new coal-fired power plant in the United States. It's much more complicated than that, but that is one of the things that it's done. And I just want to focus on that because, again, if we look at what the mission of EPA is, it's what has happened is now enacted a rule, an environmental rule, that has, more than any other agency, more than Department of Energy, more than Department of Commerce, more than an executive order from the White House, more than anything Congress has done, has put the nail in the coffin for new coal-fired power plants. You cannot build one today. It's just simply not possible under this rulemaking unless something changes. And so, I think this is kind of a testament to how it's not just environmental regulations we're talking about anymore. It's this intersection increasingly of the environment and energy. And a lot of people focus on new source performance standards. It is probably the most significant. I'm sure we'll probably come back to it in discussion and talk about some of the details. But there's lots of other rules too. The cross-state air pollution rule, the mercury rule, 316B, the upcoming NAAQS determinations. These are all environmental regulations. They're all intended to, you know, reduce environmental pollutants. But at the same time, the impact is felt on energy, and the impact is being felt on kind of changing, again, not only the mix of what type of energy you can combust in the United States to generate electricity in industrial processes, but also the way you use that energy. And one of the things that's going to be coming down the pike, I think, in the next few years are other new source performance standards going to other manufacturing sectors like petroleum refinery that will not only kind of control the type of energy going in, most of them use natural gas anyway, but actually the way they use it and become effectively industry-wide energy efficiency standards. So that's kind of my first point in terms of environmental regulations are changing, I think, along with the mission of EPA. But beyond just kind of this transition to energy regulation, there are some real challenges that are becoming more formidable, I think, for those who are interested or concerned about challenging environmental regulations. And it's not just, you know, kind of the stereotyped industry groups. There's lots of NGOs that challenge environmental regulations too. I think in most EPA cases, you probably have both industry groups and NGO groups, both as petitioners, challenging different elements of the rules. And a lot of these things apply to both sides. I think one of the things that's evolving is deference. I think most of the folks in the room are lawyers, and we all know the Chevron Doctrine well. It's been applied religiously by the D.C. Circuit, of as well as many other courts and the Supreme Court. But I have seen a trend in, like, I'd say the last 18 months, 24 months, there was a D.C. Circuit in particular, and now maybe even arguably the Supreme Court, are expanding the Chevron Doctrine to some extent. I think we saw it last year in this case that David mentioned, Citizens for Responsible Regulation, which talked about EPA's authority under the Clean Air Act to regulate greenhouse gases. And the court, in one part of the decision, has kind of been overlooked, held that some parties had standing to challenge elements of the tailoring rule, but ultimately held that EPA's interpretation was unambiguous, that it had no choice but to proceed the way it did, and it was not open to Chevron Step 2. EPA didn't have to have deference because its interpretation was unambiguous. And I take issue with that. I think it's hard for anyone to argue the Clean Air Act is unambiguous. I think the challenge is if the court had gone to Chevron Step 2, it would have had a hard time, EPA would have had a hard time justifying its position because it necessarily triggered absurd results. And you shouldn't be entitled to deference if you trigger absurd results in your interpretation. So the court was stuck saying this is Chevron Step 1. But again, you know, from the reaction of the crowd, I think you'd probably be sympathetic with my position. Who can argue the Clean Air Act is unambiguous? If I think we can all be in agreement on that. But nonetheless, the court held that because I don't think it wanted to reach the Chevron Step 2 question because it was not able to give EPA deference at that point. Just a couple weeks ago in the Supreme Court, there was a decision called City of Arlington, which expanded the Chevron. Some people would argue it expanded, some people would argue it confirmed it, but it also made it clear that the Chevron doctrine applies even further, not only to kind of technical and policy decisions made by an agency, but also decisions by the agency to kind of define its own jurisdiction. And for an agency like EPA, which is, you know, not always on the same page as its federal family, like the Department of Transportation, the Army Corps of Engineers, the Department of Energy, I think it's going to allow EPA to kind of take expansive views of its jurisdiction. We saw that happen just last year in a decision called Mingo-Logan, where the EPA on its own initiative vetoed an Army Corps of Engineer permit and was recently upheld by the D.C. Circuit in doing so, saying despite the fact the Army Corps had primary jurisdiction, it exercised a unilateral veto over this. And I think cases like the City of Arlington would probably give EPA more kind of ammunition to be broadly expanding its jurisdiction. And then finally, when it comes to deference, I think I've always been a believer in this, going back to my EPA days. It's always been challenging in court to argue with EPA on science and technical issues so long as they've established a record. I think the D.C. Circuit and other courts have continued to affirm that proposition and probably make it even stronger, that if your argument is you're going to challenge EPA because you disagree with the science or the technical approach, you have a real uphill challenge. unless there's some fundamental flaw in the record or procedural error you can point out to the court. And I think there's been some recent decisions that have kind of reaffirmed that. The other, I think, increasing challenges, which I know we're going to get to in the discussion, the second I would say is standing. Whether it's the environmental context or not, it's been clear that, again, the D.C. Circuit, which is a court we focus on a lot because so many of the EPA rulemakings get challenged there, the court seems to, at least in the last, I'd say, 24 to 36 months, elevated the bar in terms of what you have to show to establish standing if you're challenging an EPA rulemaking. Now, we can debate, and we have debated, whether it's actually raised the standard of causation, redressability, and the other elements of standard. I'm actually more skeptical that the standards themselves hasn't changed, but I do think the court is requiring a heightened showing to be able to meet the standing thresholds. And a number of cases that would have been very strong on the merits have been bounced out of the court because the parties didn't meet standing. We can talk about all those cases. There's five or six of them that are really relevant, but the one that's probably most timely right now is a case called the E15 decision. This is a case where a wide variety of groups, including industry groups, NGOs, and food groups, were challenging EPA's decision to grant a waiver to allow ethanol up to 15% concentrations in the fuel stream. And the majority panel of the DC Circuit held that none of these groups had standing, I think including automobile manufacturers. And right now the case is on review by the Supreme Court. There's been cert petitions filed. It's on the conference for June. And I think it really does beg the question in this case, if none of those parties had standing to challenge E15, does any party have standing in those cases? And I think it'll be interesting to see what happens later this month, where the court grants standing on that. It could be a very significant case going forward in terms of setting the standing framework in the D.C. Circuit and other courts and challenging rulemakings. And the third topic I'm just going to mention by name because I think we're going to get into it in the Q&A, and David mentioned it too, is this sue and settle kind of, it's the buzzword of the day in Washington, but I think it's a very serious, legitimate issue that has some real pragmatic reasons for why this is happening, but also some concerns, very significant concerns for perhaps why it's gotten out of control, and things that could be done to both enable the government to settle cases it needs to settle, but also ensure transparency, public participation, and make sure all interested stakeholders are involved in these discussions. Now, finally, just to close, I mentioned I was going to have a third small theme here of, despite kind of these challenges, what are some opportunities? And even though there have been challenges, even though things are changing, there have been cases that have helped define in the last few years when you can challenge rulemaking and what are the parameters of those challenges. The cross-state air pollution rule, the Portland cement case, the challenge to EPA cellulosic biofuel decision, the low carbon fuel standard. The theme that emerges from these cases where parties have been successful in challenging rulemakings is that the courts are receptive when there's been a procedural violation, when EPA hasn't fully complied with the APA, something as simple as not giving notice and comment, as changing their mind in the final rule versus the proposed rule and not giving a proper opportunity to consider that, and simply going outside the constraints of the legal standards in the Clean Air Act. There have been cases where groups have been successful in both establishing standing and the merits, and those cases tell us to focus on the legal issues, on the procedural errors. They don't sound as sexy sometimes to say, I filed a comment and EPA didn't respond to it, and I'm going to go to D.C. Circuit and complain about it, but frankly, those are the cases that you have a higher likelihood of winning than saying, I disagree with them and setting a standard based on a technical dispute. There are a number of cases I think that the Supreme Court is going to take a hard look at in the next couple months. We talked about E15, which has been conference for June. Come September, we'll get a decision from the court on whether it's going to hear cert in the greenhouse gas cases David was talking about, and I think some folks think that's a higher than average likelihood candidate for cert. And then we talked about the Mingo Logan case too, this EPA veto of an Army Corps decision to allow mountaintop mining in West Virginia. I haven't seen anything publicly about whether cert will be sought there, but it seems like a ripe candidate given the court's past precedent on Clean Water Act cases and these types of cases involving interagency disputes and jurisdiction. So with that, I'll turn it back to you, Coral.
Roger, you pointed out something that I've noticed a lot in my own reporting of energy and EPA, which is EPA is indeed taking a much larger role as an energy regulator. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One is, you know, we have the Clean Air Act of 1992, which says, the Clean Air Act says, and I should say I'm not a lawyer. There are many more lawyers in the room here than I. But my understanding is that the Clean Air Act says the EPA has to regulate anything defined as a pollutant, anything that defined as harming human health. Massachusetts EPA versus EPA said EPA has to determine whether or not carbon is a pollutant. In 2009, EPA did that. That set the stage for EPA to be required under the law to regulate carbon. That's a huge new role for it, but it's required under the law. Under that finding, any administration would be forced then to legally go forward and regulate carbon. And then the other piece of this is, in the 1992 Clean Air Act amendments that set up the legal requirements that EPA do, the cross-state air rule, which affects coal plants, the mercury rule, which affects coal plants. And those rules were sitting around for 20 years before EPA finally went ahead and started regulating them putting those rules out in the first Obama term. But the argument there is that under the law, an EPA under any administration would be required to, by the law, to go in. And David, you're shaking your head. I mean, what's answer that and then and say, what should be happening instead?
Well, should I go ahead or by? A couple of things. The act is not nearly as confining. All but Supreme Court said in Massachusetts is that carbon is a pollutant, and therefore EPA has to consider regulating. For purposes of 212, forget the section, for tailpipe control purposes. EPA easily could have come with a decision in the endangerment findings, which would have been challenged in the D.C. Circuit, which basically said that given the utterly minuscule contribution that automotive emissions, light-duty vehicle emissions in the United States make to a problem, so much so that if we were dealing with a normal article freestanding, which is the first injury in fact, second is causation, and not the statutory issue. It just makes no sense. It makes absolutely no difference. And all of the other speculation about how if we regulated tailpipe emissions, the rest of the world would regulate tailpipe emissions versus having a free rider problem. So EPA could have easily said no. It would have passed muster. Second, I find, and again, maybe bolder than I typically am, I would not say it in court, but I find the argument that because Congress came up with a capacious definition of pollutant in a very complex statute and has specific controlled strategy programs, each of which, even in a post-Schechter poultry world, doesn't say to EPA, go regulate for public good. It tells you how to regulate. And you have a PSD program that has, talking about Chevron 1, Roger, has freaking number, 250 tons. And if you cannot regulate it the way the Congress intended, so sorry to say, I remember the colloquy that Roger is referring to in this is arising after challenge, we cannot do it. Well, cannot do it. Congress really didn't mean for you to do it. The question of how do you harmonize different provisions. So clean, I mean, to paraphrase a statement once made about the Constitution not being a suicide pact, the Clean Air Act is not a mandate to regulate things that cannot be regulated in accordance with a specific scheme that Congress laid out. So you could have been, and I would bet you, even with all the problems in the D.C. Circuit, EPA came at it in one rule, there's at least a very good chance, and they basically say, look, we cannot, all the arguments they made in the tailing rule, we cannot regulate this the way Congress intended us to regulate. But if you look at the legislative history of the PSD program, one of the reasons you have this tight cabining is because Congress did not trust EPA not to pick favorites. They wanted to give them a binary choice. You either do PSD as you find it, or you don't do it. It would have been easy peasy to defend that. And even if he lost in the D.C. Circuit, that would have been a very strong candidate for the Supreme Court. And much as I appreciate Kennedy's position in Mass, Kennedy would have looked at it and said, not quite what we meant. We didn't mean to say go regulate carbon under all these programs. No, the agency did what it did because, I'm sorry to say, it was Weasley. Because it wanted to minimize litigation burdens and to write the statute. So it's not true with respect that the die was cast on the Clean Air Act. The broader problem is what we have now is statutes that were not meant to be doing this stuff at all. We have an agency operating in a freestyle fashion, playing God. And again, I keep mentioning Schechter poultry, fancy word for us, we're not lawyers about virtually standardless delegation, but virtually standardless doesn't mean standardless. You cannot let EPA regulate just because they think it makes sense. Roger?
Yeah.
Just briefly, I'm not going to dispute what Massachusetts versus EPA says, even though I was the council of record that lost that case. But I do agree that it says what it says. And even though I'm involved in the greenhouse gas litigation, I am not someone who's filed a cert petition before the Supreme Court saying undo Mass versus EPA. There's other folks that have done that. But I do think the distinction is in the difference of how they have executed both the language of the Clean Air Act and the language of Massachusetts versus EPA. And I think, you know, David again focused on the example of what they did in response to the CAR regulations and the ramifications. But I'll go back to this new source performance standard example. And I know we're being recorded and I'm on the record here, but I'll stick my neck out, and I've said this before. I do think that this was legally the shakiest rule of the last 4 years, because the new source performance standards are all about setting performance standards based on the best demonstrated technology. These are cost-benefit analysis. These are technologies that exist today, what you've been able to demonstrate. And we just want to make sure if it's a new facility, it's being based on the best demonstrated technology. What they did for new source performance standards for utilities and greenhouse gases was to set a standard by which no coal-fired power plant can achieve. It's not best demonstrated technology. It's technology that is not achievable. You cannot build a facility that can meet this technology. So it's not a question of whether the Clean Air Act or Massachusetts versus the EPA requires them to do so. I think it's a question of how they did it. And there's nothing in Mass versus EPA or the Clean Air Act that says set a standard for best demonstrated technology that cannot be achieved by any facility. So that's where I take issue, not so much with what their mandate is. If I was there today as general counsel, I'm sure I'd be coming up with options. Here's all the things we have to do to satisfy these mandates. But I do think in some of the implementation that they've kind of gone beyond their authority.
Roger, not to press you, do you not agree that, if not to be partisan here, because I understand, you know, original version of Johnson Memorandum, do you not think that a different administration might have had a very different regulatory course relative to what do you do post Mass versus EPA, and would have held, yeah, I understand what happened in the D.C. Circuit for a living, but it would have had a very different run, if you will, litigation-wise, had it proceeded, because in part, let me just say this briefly, in part, here is EPA recarved the PSD, rewrote the PSD program. If it didn't do so, if it basically came up with all arguments about impossibility, blah, 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 and laid it out before the court, what would decision say in remand? No, we as a court are going to rewrite it to say 75,000 or 100,000. You just told us, or the decision that something is impossible for the agency to administer, ladies and gentlemen, is at the height of Chevron deference. I mean, whatever, you know, Raj and I agree about the city of Arlington and various other issues, but one thing the agency gets absolute deference on is we cannot do it. It's impossible. What would the D.C. Circuit, even with a certain panel, actually, not, what would it say? No. We know better, we're going to rewrite it for you. It would have been a different animal, don't you think?
I clearly think they could have taken some different paths that under and complied with Mass versus EPA, and just briefly two things they could have done. For example, they issued a legal determination that says if we regulate greenhouse gases from cars, we have to therefore regulate greenhouse gases from stationary sources under the PSD program. I disagree with that. They could have come up with a legal determination that easily could have interpreted the Clean Air Act differently, as they had done at one point, and said our CAR regulations are not linked to the PSD program. That's the position we're advocating in the Supreme Court. That's the position that Judge Kavanaugh agreed with in a very lengthy dissent. But even if you say, okay, they were right on that, that necessarily there's a trigger, there's another option. They could have deferred to the Department of Transportation and said DOT can enact these CAFE standards. The Supreme Court said even though you have to issue an endangerment determination, the timing of that determination, the timing of your regulations is subject to your discretion, to your deference. And so I do think they were not kind of hamstrung like they said they were. They were compelled to only do one thing, and this was a course that was kind of locked in stone back in 1990 when the Clean Air Act was amended and, you know, further cemented by Mass versus EPA. Those are just two examples, I think, of a broader range of options that could have been considered.
Roger, you mentioned timing. The EPA, you know, when these regulations go out, EPA is given its own agency to decide when it's going to do them. And you mentioned before the issue of sue and settle cases. Can you put those together, lay out what's going on with sue and settle, with the new source performance review, and also a lot of the regulations that we saw in the first term?
Sure, thank you. And so what I think of when I think of sue and settle is the notion that EPA is under deadlines to do a lot of things, either statutory deadlines or court deadlines. Statutory deadlines every so years, they have to renew this standard or that standard.
That's already built into the law.
Already built into the law. And then there's also court deadlines that go way back, you know, consent decrees that go way back that require them to do certain things by certain times. EPA has a lot to do, they have limited resources, and so it's very common that they miss more deadlines than they meet, and that's not a critique, it's just part of limited government resources. But what has happened, I think, over time, and particularly in the last 24 months, 36 months, is certain groups have kind of seized on those missed deadlines, and they file a notice letter with the EPA saying, we're going to sue you in 60 days to force you to comply with this deadline. Just happened a couple weeks ago with Ozone NAAQS. There's a notice letter that's been filed. And in return, EPA has been responding by saying, we will negotiate a schedule with you by which we will agree to do this. And there's a couple ramifications from that that are troubling and concerning. First of all, what it does is it kind of changes the priorities of the agency. The agency should decide its priorities. But if you have groups that are filing notice letters and settling with the agency, they become, in effect, quasi-governmental. They're saying, this issue is more important than what you think the issue is. We want to take this issue and elevate it beyond what you wanted to do, so we're going to enter a schedule with you. So they're effectively changing the agenda of the agency. The other concern is that when EPA is in these negotiations, as far as I'm aware of, and someone raised their hand if you know about this, but they don't invite other people to the discussions. These rules affect broader than just the groups filing notice letters. The groups who filed the Ozone NAAQS letter is just a small subset of people being affected by it. But I doubt EPA is going to invite a broader group of people, including the industries affected by it, to participate in the negotiations. And then finally, these deadlines that come out are overly fast. We saw that in PM NAAQS last year, that EPA had to rush through rulemaking much faster than otherwise could have, gave short shrift to public comments and so on. So as a result, as Coral points out, these missed deadlines are being resolved through these sue and settlement discussions. I frankly think EPA has more authority to say, we have discretion regarding the timing of our regulations. The Supreme Court just affirmed that. As long as we're working diligently toward it, as long as we're studying the issue and we're making progress, I think the court is going to cut EPA a lot of slack. And I would not be so scared to be settling all these cases. I was a Justice Department lawyer before I was an EPA lawyer. I'd be happy to be standing up defending EPA in a lot of these cases and saying, court, we need more time. No one's ignoring this. We're working on it hard. We've got limited resources with all these deadlines. And we need more time than what, you know, someone's trying to compel us to do. And we have to be concerned that this is not the only rulemaking at EPA. We have a broader docket, and the agency should be enabled to kind of set its own agenda, not have other outside groups set that agenda for it.
Briefly, I agree. In fact, I would say, apropos of other forms of law enforcement discretion arguments in the context of immigration law and various other things, I agree with Roger. I would love to argue a case which basically says, look, we got this many resources in terms of personnel and budgets, we can only do so much, instead of approaching every unreasonable delay action as a silo. But I would just also add there's a more cynical explanation of what's happening here, which I think Roger will know what I'm going to say. A more cynical explanation, it's really not the agency being pushed by the groups, it's agency entering in a conspiracy of sorts with groups because they're able to carry the day with their political masters. And never worked at EPA, but I worked at the Justice Department, DOE, and the White House Counsel's Office. And all the time, you have a situation where they come in and say, well, no, you can't really scrub this rule. We are under consent decree. So the agency benefits from these arrangements as much as it's pushed by it, unfortunately. Or sections of it, factions in the agency.
So I've asked the EPA recently about the sue and settles. And their argument is twofold. On one hand, they say when these cases are brought, if the EPA were to fight back and drag these lawsuits out, ultimately that ends up taking more time, more resources, and costing more taxpayer dollars at the end of the day. And they'll say, well, you know, they'll come, you know, when these groups come in, it's actually faster, easier, and cost less, you know, less burden on the taxpayer to do a settlement. And they'll also argue that in some cases, certainly in the case of rules like you know, the mercury rules in the first term, that those rules had been sitting out there for 20 years and hadn't been implemented. And, you know, it wasn't an appropriate argument at that point to say, well, we should continue to drag it out. That's the argument of the EPA. What would be your...
Well, I think we can break that apart with one example. I'm going to go back to New Source Performance Standards. It was December of 2000. I could get my years wrong, so please don't hold me to it. I think it was December of 2010 that EPA agreed to a consent decree in the New Source Performance Standards. They agreed to do four things. They agreed to propose a New Source Performance Standard for utilities, for new utilities and existing utilities, I think by July of that year, and finalize it by December. So they did new and existing utilities, one and two, and then they agreed to propose new source performance standards for refineries by fall of that year, and then finalize them like 6 months after that. So far, they've only been able to meet one of those four, and they did that like 18 months late. They've been able to propose new source performance standards for a new utilities only. So that was a case where, first of all, they agreed to a schedule that they could not agree to, so I don't see how that saves taxpayer money if they're, as opposed to having a Justice Department lawyer stand up in court and saying we need more time to do all these things, they ended up, you know, accelerating something that they probably weren't going to do and still were unable to do it. And so you wonder what else wasn't able to get done. But they not only, I think this is really important because a lot of times we talk about schedules and deadlines, they not only committed to a schedule for these roles, which again, they weren't able to meet a single one. I'm not complaining about it. I don't hope someone listens and say, well, hurry up. But they agreed not only to the deadlines, but they also agreed to a significant substantive decision. They agreed to enact these standards for existing facilities, not just new, but existing as well. And this is an untested question. At this point in history, EPA has not enacted new source performance standards for existing facilities, other than a small handful of exceptions for some like landfills and things that aren't subject to Section 112. So it's not just a procedural decision they made, it was a substantive commitment they made to these groups as well. And so I think it's more than just them trying to save like resources and taxpayer money. In this case, it went beyond just a schedule, it went also into a substantive issue. And I had to ask, why would they do this without kind of involving other stakeholders in the process until only having to have the chance to defend on a court and say, maybe we don't have to do this for existing facilities. All that was prejudged because of this consent decree.
And I volunteered to make an observation because at least some people in the agency wanted to be in that position, and it's going to be much more difficult to challenge that foundational decision relative to NSPS for existing sources given that consent decree. And it's, again, the classical shell game, similar at least at 60,000 feet above the battlefield to splitting things into four rules. It's extremely unfortunate.
I want to ask about one other different energy issue and then move into Q&A, which is fracking. You know, you talked about the regulation, how EPA is turning into an agency that is an energy regulator. One of the biggest stories in the last couple of years in the U.S. has been the explosion of fracking. We now see hydraulic fracturing and energy development in parts of the country that we've never seen it. We see it, obviously, in North Dakota, in Ohio, in Arkansas. There's all in, you know, parts of Colorado. In Pennsylvania, so there's a lot of new energy exploration and energy resources in parts of the country that hadn't seen it before, and don't necessarily have regulations in place. So there's a debate starting on, well, what's the appropriate way to oversee and regulate fracking? The concern is that fracking, if not appropriately regulated, potentially can hurt water resources, can cause environmental damage. Can cause methane leaks. This debate is starting now. What's the appropriate role for EPA, particularly in areas where fracking is happening with limited regulation?
Right, and this is a fascinating question because, as you point out, Coral, hydraulic fracturing is probably the most significant energy issue in the United States, and some people would argue it's the most significant environmental issue, but it's primarily a state and local driven issue, depending on the state. In some cases there's a state, in some cases there's authority for local regulations. And the best example of this is Pennsylvania and New York, where in Pennsylvania you have, you know, shale that is basically, there's an artificial geographical boundary going between the two states. And in Pennsylvania there's vibrant hydraulic fracturing, some would argue economic benefits from that. In New York there's a ban and a moratorium right now. So it has been up until this point primarily a state issue, and some states are very stringent, some states are more receptive. I think it's fair to say every state cares about the environmental consequences of it. But from EPA's perspective, it's tough because this is the most significant energy issue in the country right now. I think they've addressed coal, they've addressed cars. But from an environmental perspective, they're kind of hamstrung. They have limited legal authority to address what they probably perceive as the biggest environmental thing going on in front of their eyes, but they can't really get in there and do much about it. So two things are going on, maybe three things. I think the first thing is they're studying it. There's been lots of studies underway, lots of studies they're working on. I think part of that is both getting information that they want to get into the public domain, perhaps that states would then use in their own regulations, but also perhaps set the framework for EPA regulations. The second thing that's going on right now is they are looking at what kind of organic regulatory authority do they have under the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, RCRA, TSCA. do they have any kind of ways to get grips on hydraulic fracturing to perhaps set some national environmental baselines? There's no clear answer to them for that. I think the answer is probably there's not a lot of opportunities. They've done some things with underground injection control. They're looking at some of the chemicals that go into fracturing. They're looking at some of the air emissions and aggregating air emissions among wells and things like that to try to get a hold on it. But there's no real clear kind of explicit authority to kind of be playing at what is primarily a state regulatory issue. I think the third thing going on, and this is now my speculation, having said all that, I don't see them sitting this out. It's not EPA's culture to sit out what is, you know, the most significant energy environmental issue in the country. And so I do anticipate they're going to get creative to try to find ways to maybe do backdoor controls over fracturing. There's some examples of that we can talk about. But also maybe even to maybe push the envelope a bit of some other statutory authority in the next few years to again set the notion of national baselines that'll be uniform across all states, and then some states could become stringent. I don't have details in terms of what they might be thinking, but I can't imagine they're not looking at all options and taking a really hard look at that given their mission.
And we're actually running up on time, so I want to open up to Q&A, and there is the mic over here. I saw a gentleman. Do you want to?
Could you just address the role of the Department of Interior with respect to a possible jurisdiction and best practices there?
Sure. In terms of Interior, their primary role is they own so many lands, particularly in the West, on which people want to engage in exploratory wells and hydraulic fracturing. And so they, you know, Interior plays this role primarily in terms of if you want to drill on the Monterey Shale, for example, in California, you have to go through and get a BLM permit. And that's going to raise ramifications that don't come up for the average private party who wants to lease their well in Pennsylvania. They have to then deal with NEPA, the Endangered Species Act, and EPA review and all the various other requirements. And so the opportunities are too huge to not pay attention to federal lands, but definitely adds a lot of kind of red tape and legal issues beyond what is happening. I think Interior recognizes that, and they're working on a number of policies as well, I think, to both streamline and address the issues that are unique to federal lands and fracturing.
Roman Bueller with the Madison Coalition. Two questions. First of all, what do you think of the concept recently passed by the House of requiring that Congress approve a certain threshold of major new federal regulation? And the second is this issue of court settlements. Can you envision any kind of legislative approach to limiting the power of agencies to engage in court settlements of the type that you've described as an abuse?
Maybe I could just address the settlement point and turn it over to David for the first. There is actually some very good proposals on the Hill right now, one called the Sunshine Act. That's the short term for it. And there's another one as well. I've testified on Congress twice on some of these proposals. And I think they strike the right balance because what they do is they don't discourage settlements. And I don't discourage settlements. I was a DOJ lawyer. I think settlements are very effective for the government. But what they do is they promote transparency, public participation. They have a process by which if EPA were to engage in a settlement agreement, parties would have to be notified, have a seat at the table, an opportunity to have their views be heard for a court to review that. So there's no proposal out there that says settlement's a bad idea. And I don't think settlement's a bad idea. I think settlement's a great idea. But I think what they do and what I would propose is they get at the notion of ensuring transparency and public participation in these settlements.
I'm a reasonable critic of administrative state as we have now. To me, having Congress approve every major regulation is kind of a clumsy way of dealing with a problem. It's better than the status quo, but what's needed really is a fundamental structural revision of all the statutes in the books because they work quite well, spend hundreds of billions of dollars, got a lot of benefits over a number of decades. In fact, what I've been dying to say, but I'll get into that now, the very fact that Roger and I are both agreeing about how wrong and difficult it would be to deal with a fracking problem, the solution is go get a good statute that addresses this. It's not a job for EPA or any other agencies. I don't think I'm just being hard on EPA to play God and say, there's a problem out there. Well, let's see if we can grab a piece from this and a piece from that, and you're going to have some kind of regulatory scheme. It's a horrible solution. You need to come up. Congress needs to be involved. I would like to see, for example, all major statutes sunsetting at periodic. It's interesting. Very briefly, look at things like the Patriot Act. Sunsets because everybody is concerned about privacy. Here you got the Clean Air Act that doesn't sunset. Here you got the Clean Water. I mean, there's a better way of involving Congress in dealing with those issues versus doing a regulation by regulation scrub.
Carol Whiten, I'm in the Air Force General Counsel's office. Broader question than the energy issue. Most of the issues we see with agencies are the de facto regulation via guidance, which has a very long DC circuit history of, frankly, most agencies getting shot down every time they try to do it. So it's not like there isn't precedent and instruction out there for agents to say, to agencies to say you shouldn't be trying to regulate via guidance documents. But are there any potential solutions for that situation? Because in many circumstances, you don't have a party who has the financial capability of challenging that kind of an action. Or in my case, a federal agency can't challenge the other federal agency because practically there is no forum in which you can really have a true case. So that's the question. Any solution for that problem?
I'm really glad you brought it up. Now I'm a little embarrassed. I should have had that on my list of challenges because it is super significant and is also something that's trending. It's getting to the point where rules are now being released with simultaneous guidances because there's some things they don't want in the rule. And so an agency will say, well, here's the rule and then here's our guidance, and you can challenge the rule, but you can't challenge our guidance. And we all know that, you know, who's not going to follow the guidance? Like, which region is going to say, well, we're going to ignore the guidance? And so it is getting kind of out of hand. I think the court deserves credit for calling the bluffs on these on several occasions where it should have. But as you point out, there's some real challenges to doing so. It takes a lot of money and a lot of resources and a lot of time to challenge these rules. I do think as, you know, more agency officials go through confirmation processes, I could see Congress focusing on this in the future and trying to, you know, really drill into the future leaders of not just EPA, but all these agencies to make sure that they're committed to not kind of undermining the Managed Service Procedure Act and other, you know, core concepts of rulemaking to just put things in. I mean, there's definitely a legitimate role for guidances, but when you have guidances that are truly binding and controlling the rights of parties and you know everyone's going to be enforcing them the same way, that does cross the line, and it's not enough to say you have an avenue to review that. So hopefully Congress will put some pressure on these future leaders to make sure that they're being fair in terms of what should be a guidance and what should be a rule.
There is another problem here, which has manifested itself, a vengeance in the carbon context, where the agency, is, where both Raj and I mentioned subject to regulation, the legal theory or legal myth here, the subject to regulation issue was settled a long time ago. So the D.C. Circuit has a very unfortunate tendency when you try to challenge something that may have been tangentially raised decades ago or years ago in a rule which never didn't get challenged and not on that basis. Whoopsie-daisy. We're not going to be allowing you to revisit it. That is another horrible way of restricting in a very palpable way an opportunity to challenge the new course. And that was the key issue in the timing and tailoring context.
Just one more question.
Hi, Will Michella from Brownstein Hyatt Harbor Strike. I'd like you to put your Justice Department hats on. Former justice official in the Bush administration, and it seems to me, I haven't seen any studies on this, but it seems that there's an increase in the number of settlement payments to advocacy groups. In the resources area, you see this in the financial area a little bit, Fair Housing Act cases. Wanted to get your comment on the appropriateness of these payments, and actually they never actually passed through the hands of the federal government, otherwise it would be a violation of federal appropriations law. But wanted to get a sense from you, do you think it's increasing? Do you think it's appropriate? And what problems do you see from that?
I think it's increasing. I think it's troubling. I mean, it's troubling in the constitutional sense, because even if you don't call it appropriations formally, particularly given those sort of troubling combinations of factions within the executive branch, adding, you know, it really almost the joint prosecution agreements with private sector groups, having them also have resources that the agency does not have. I think it's troubling. I think, look, there are a couple of areas where fee shifting and fees are award our maybe civil rights or traditionally is appropriate. I would not do it in most other areas, and that's something for Congress to change. But I think it's always been the problem, and it's on the rise.
Yeah, and it's not only on the rise, but the bills are on the rise too. They could put private lawyers to shame if you see some of the fees that are charged by some of the public interest groups to get reimbursed. So this is definitely an increasing concern, and I think, as you know, we talk about regulatory reform and judicial reform, this sue and settle has been a primary component, but you could foresee some of these other issues starting to weave their way into some of those debates on the Hill.
I think we've just hit the end of our time. Roger, David, thank you so much.